thick and terrifically tired, and he kept pressing the heels of his hand against his temples and yawning, but as bad as he seemed to feel, he still held his grin, and once or twice went so far as to laugh out loud at some of the things the nurse kept turning up. When the nurse went in to call the main building to report Mr. Turkle's resignation, Turkle and the girl Sandy took the opportunity to unlock that screen again and wave goodbye to all and go loping off across the grounds, stumbling and slipping on the wet, sun-sparkled grass.
"He didn't lock it back up," Harding said to McMurphy. Go on after them."
McMurphy groaned and opened one eye, bloody as a hatching egg.
"You kidding me? I couldn't even get my head through that window, let alone my whole body."
"My friend, I don't believe you fully comprehend."
"Harding, goddamn you and your big words. All I fully comprehend this morning is I'm still half drunk and sick. Matter of fact, I think you're still drunk, too. Chief, how about you? Are you still drunk?"
I said that my nose and cheeks didn't have any feeling in them yet, if this could be taken to mean anything. McMurphy nodded once and closed his eyes again. He laced his hands across his chest and slid down in his chair, his chin settling into his collar. He smacked his lips and smiled as if he were napping.
"Man," he said, "everybody is still drunk."
Harding was still concerned. He kept on about how the best thing for McMurphy to do was get dressed quickly, while old Angel of Mercy was in there calling the doctor again to report the atrocities she had uncovered. But McMurphy maintained that there wasn't anything to get excited about. He wasn't any worse off than before, was he?
"I've took their best punch," he said.
Harding threw up his hands and went off, predicting doom. One of the black boys saw the screen was unlocked and locked it and went into the nurse's station for the big flat ledger, came back out running his finger down the roll and lipping the names he read out loud as he cited the men that matched up with them. The roll is listed alphabetically backwards to throw people off, so he didn't get to the B's till right at the last. He looked around the day room without taking his finger from that last name in the ledger.
"Bibbit. Where's Billy Bibbit?"
His eyes were big. He was thinking Billy'd slipped out right under his nose and would he ever catch it.
"Who saw Billy Bibbit go, you damn goons?"
This set people to remembering just where Billy was. There were whispers and laughing again. The black boy went back into the station and we saw him telling the nurse. She smashed the phone down in the cradle and came out of the door with the black boy hot after her. A lock of her hair had broken loose from beneath her white cap and fell across her face like wet ashes. She was sweating between her eyebrows and under her nose. She demanded we tell her where the eloper had gone. She was answered with a chorus of laughter, and her eyes went around the men.
"So he's not gone, is he? Harding, he's still here on the ward, isn't he? Tell me, Seafelt, tell me."
She darted the eyes out with every word, stabbing at the men's faces, but the men were immune to her poison. Their eyes met hers. Their grins mocked the old confident smile she had lost.
"Washington, Warren, come with me for room check."
We rose and followed as the three of them went along, unlocking the lab, the tub room, the doctor's office. Scanlan covered his grin with his knotty hand and whispered,
"Hey, ain't gonna be some joke on old Billy."
We all nodded.
"And Billy's not the only one it's gonna be a joke on now that I think about it. Remember who's in there?"
The nurse reached the door of the seclusion room at the end of the hall. We pushed up close to see, crowding and craning to peep over the big nurse and the two black boys as she unlocked it and swung it open. It was dark in the windowless room. There was a squeak and a scuffle in the dark. And the nurse reached out, flicked the light down on Billy and the girl where they were blinking up from that mattress on the floor like two owls from a nest. The nurse ignored the howl of laughter behind her.
"William Bibbit."
She tried so hard to sound cold and stern.
"William Bibbit."
"Good morning, Miss Ratchet,"
Billy said, not even making any move to get up and button his pajamas. He took the girl's hand in his and grinned.
"This is Candy."
The nurse's tongue clucked in her bony throat.
"Oh, Billy, Billy, Billy. I'm so ashamed for you."
Billy wasn't awake enough to respond much to her shaming, and the girl was fussing around looking under the mattress for her nylons, moving slow and warm-looking after sleep. Every so often she would stop her dreamy fumbling and look up and smile at the icy figure of the nurse standing there with her arms crossed, then feel to see if her sweater was buttoned, and go back to tugging for her nylon caught between the mattress and the tile floor. They both moved like fat cats full of warm milk, lazy in the sun. I guess they were still fairly drunk, too.
"Oh, Billy,"
the nurse said, like she was so disappointed she might break down and cry.
"A woman like this. A cheap, low, painted."
"Courtesan?" Harding suggested. "Jezebel?"
The nurse turned and tried to nail him with her eyes, but he just went on.
"Not Jezebel, no?"
He scratched his head in thought.
"How about Salome? She's notoriously evil." "Perhaps dame is the word you want. Well, I'm just trying to help."
She swung back to Billy. He was concentrating on getting to his feet. He rolled over and came to his knees, butt in the air like a cow getting up, then pushed up on his hands, then came to one foot, then the other, and straightened. He looked pleased with his success, as if he wasn't even aware of us crowding at the door teasing him and hurrahing him. The loud talk and laughter swirled around the nurse. She looked from Billy and the girl to the bunch of us behind her. The enamel and plastic face was caving in. She shut her eyes and strained to calm her trembling, concentrating. She knew this was it, her back to the wall. When her eyes opened again, they were very small and still.
"What worries me, Billy," she said. I could hear the change in her voice, "is how your poor mother is going to take this."
She got the response she was after. Billy flinched and put his hand to his cheek like he'd been burned with acid.
"Mrs. Bibbitt's always been so proud of your discretion. I know she has. This is going to disturb her terribly. You know how she is when she gets disturbed, Billy. You know how ill the poor woman can become. She's very sensitive, especially concerning her son. She always spoke so proudly of you. She all..."
Nah!
His mouth was working. He shook his head, begging her,
"You don't need..."
"Billy, Billy, Billy," she said. "Your mother and I are old friends."
"No!"
he cried. His voice scraped the white bare walls of the seclusion room. He lifted his chin so he was shouting at the moon of light in the ceiling.
No!
We stopped laughing. We watched Billy folding into the floor, head going back, knees coming forward. He rubbed his hand up and down that green pant leg. He was shaking his head in panic, like a kid that's been promised a whipping just as soon as a willow is cut. The nurse touched his shoulder to comfort him. The touch shook him like a blow.
"Billy, I don't want her to believe something like this of you, but what am I to think?"
Don't tell Miss Pratchett.
"Billy, I have to tell. I hate to believe you would behave like this, but really, what else can I think? I find you alone, on a mattress, with this sort of woman."
"No, I didn't. I was..."
His hand went to his cheek again and stuck there.
"She did."
"Billy, this girl could not have pulled you in here forcibly."
She shook her head.
"Understand. I would like to believe something else, for your poor mother's sake."
The hand pulled down his cheek, raking long red marks.
"She did.
He looked around him.
"And McMurphy, he did, and Harding, and the rest, they teased me, called me things."
Now his face was fastened to hers. He didn't look to one side or the other, but only straight ahead at her face. Like there was a spiraling light there instead of features, a hypnotizing swirl of cream white and blue and orange. He swallowed and waited for her to say something, but she wouldn't. Her skill, her fantastic mechanical power, flooded back into her, analyzing the situation and reporting to her that all she had to do was keep quiet.
They made me! Please, Miss Ratchet! They made!
She checked her beam, and Billy's face pitched downward, sobbing with relief. She put a hand on his neck and drew his cheek to her starched breast, stroking his shoulder while she turned a slow, contemptuous look across the bunch of us. It's all right, Billy. It's all right. No one else is going to harm you. It's all right. I'll explain to your mother. She continued to glare at us as she spoke. It was strange to hear that voice, soft and soothing and warm as a pillow, coming out of a face as hard as porcelain. All right, Billy. Come along with me. You can wait over here in the doctor's office. There's no reason for you to be submitted to sitting out in the day room with these friends of yours. She led him into the office, stroking his bowed head and saying, Poor boy. Poor little boy. While we faded back down the hall silently and sat down in the day room without looking at one another or speaking, McMurphy was the last one to take a seat. The chronics across the way had stopped milling around and were settling into their slots. I looked at McMurphy out of the corner of my eye, trying not to be obvious about it. He was in his chair in the corner, resting a second before he came out for the next round, and a long line of next rounds. The thing he was fighting, you couldn't whip it for good. All you could do was keep on whipping it till you couldn't come out anymore, and somebody else had to take your place. There was more phoning going on in the nurse's station, and a number of authorities showing up for a tour of the evidence. When the doctor himself finally came in, every one of these people gave him a look like the whole thing had been planned by him, or at least condoned and authorized. He was white and shaky under their eyes. You could see he'd already heard about most of what had gone on here, on his ward, but the big nurse outlined it for him again, in slow, loud details, so we could hear it too. Hear it in the proper way this time, solemnly, with no whispering or giggling while she talked. The doctor nodded and fiddled with his glasses, batting eyes so watery I thought he must be splashing her. She finished by telling him about Billy and the tragic experience we had put the poor boy through. I left him in your office. Judging from his present state, I suggest you see him right away. He's been through a terrible ordeal. I shudder to think of the damage that must have been done to the poor boy. She waited until the doctor shuddered too. I think you should go see if you can speak with him. He needs a lot of sympathy. He's in a pitiful state. The doctor nodded again and walked off toward his office. We watched him go. Mac, Scanlon said. Listen, you don't think any of us are being taken in by this crap, do you? It's bad, but we know where the blame lies. We ain't blaming you. No, I said. None of us blame you. And wished I'd had my tongue pulled out as soon as I saw the way he looked at me. He closed his eyes and relaxed. Waiting, it looked like. Harding got up and walked over to him, and had just opened his mouth to say something, when the doctor's voice, screaming down the hall, smashed a common horror and realization onto everybody's face.
Nurse!
He yelled.
Good Lord, nurse!
She ran, and the three black boys ran, down the hall to where the doctor was still calling. But not a patient got up. We knew there wasn't anything for us to do now but just sit tight and wait for her to come to the day room to tell us what we all had known was one of the things that was bound to happen. She walked straight to McMurphy. He cut his throat, she said. She waited, hoping he would say something. He wouldn't look up. He opened the doctor's desk and found some instruments and cut his throat. The poor, miserable, misunderstood boy killed himself. He's there now, in the doctor's chair, with his throat cut. She waited again, but he still wouldn't look up. First Charles Cheswick, and now William Bibbit. I hope you're finally satisfied. Playing with human lives.
gambling with human lives as if you thought yourself to be a god.
She turned and walked into the nurse's station and closed the door behind her, leaving a shrill, killing cold sound ringing in the tubes of light over our heads. First, I had a quick thought to try to stop him, talk him into taking what he'd already won, and let her have the last round. But another, bigger thought wiped that first thought away completely. I suddenly realized with a crystal certainty that neither I nor any of the half-score of us could stop him, that Harding's arguing or my grabbing him from behind or old Colonel Matterson's teaching or Scanlon's griping or all of us together couldn't rise up and stop him. We couldn't stop him because we were the ones making him do it. It wasn't the nurse that was forcing him. It was our need that was making him push himself slowly up from sitting, his big hands driving down on the leather chair arms, pushing him up, rising and standing like one of those moving picture zombies, obeying orders beamed at him from 40 masters. It was us that had been making him go on for weeks, keeping him standing long after his feet and legs had given out, weeks of making him wink and grin and laugh and go on with his act, long after his humor had been parched dry between two electrodes. We made him stand and hitch up his black shorts like they were horsehide chaps and push back his cap with one finger like it was a 10-gallon Stetson. Slow mechanical gestures. And when he walked across the floor, you could hear the iron in his bare heels ring sparks out of the tile. Only at the last, after he'd smashed through that glass door, her face swinging around, with terror forever ruining any other look she might ever try to use again, screaming when he grabbed for her and ripped her uniform all the way down the front, screaming again when the two nippled circles started from her chest and swelled out and out, bigger than anybody had ever even imagined, warm and pink in the light. Only at the last, after the officials realized that the three black boys weren't going to do anything but stand and watch, and they would have to beat him off without their help, doctors and supervisors and nurses prying those heavy red fingers out of the white flesh of her throat as if they were her neck bones, jerking him backward off her with a loud heave of breath. Only then did he show any sign that he might be anything other than a sane, willful, dogged man performing a hard duty that finally just had to be done, like it or not. He gave a cry. At the last, falling backward, his face appearing to us for a second upside down before he was smothered on the floor by a pile of white uniforms, he let himself cry out. A sound of cornered animal fear and hate and surrender and defiance, that if you ever trailed coon or cougar or lynx, is like the last sound the treed and shot and falling animal makes as the dogs get him, when he finally doesn't care anymore about anything but himself and his dying. I hung around another couple of weeks to see what was to come. Everything was changing. Seafelt and Fredrickson signed out together against medical advice, and 2 days later another three acutes left, and six more transferred to another ward. There was a lot of investigation about the party on the ward, and about Billy's death, and the doctor was informed that his resignation would be accepted, and he informed them that they would have to go the whole way and can him if they wanted him out. The big nurse was over in medical for a week, so for a while we had the little Jap nurse from Disturbed running the ward. That gave the guys a chance to change a lot of the ward policy. By the time the big nurse came back, Harding had even got the tub room back open and was in there dealing blackjack himself, trying to make that airy, thin voice of his sound like McMurphy's auctioneer bellow. He was dealing when he heard her key hit the lock. We all left the tub room and came out in the hall to meet her, to ask about McMurphy. She jumped back two steps when we approached, and I thought for a second she might run. Her face was bloated blue and out of shape on one side, closing one eye completely, and she had a heavy bandage around her throat, and a new white uniform. Some of the guys grinned at the front of it, in spite of its being smaller and tighter and more starched than her old uniforms. It could no longer conceal the fact that she was a woman. Smiling, Harding stepped up close and asked what had become of Mac. She took a little pad and pencil from the pocket of her uniform and wrote, "He will be back" on it, and passed it around. The paper trembled in her hand. "Are you sure?" Harding wanted to know after he read it.
We'd heard all kinds of things. That he'd knocked down two aides on Disturbed and taken their keys and escaped. That he'd been sent back to the work farm. Even that the nurse in charge now till they got a new doctor was giving him special therapy.
Are you quite positive?
Harding repeated. The nurse took out her pad again. She was stiff in the joints, and her more than ever white hands skittered on the pad like one of those arcade gypsies that scratch out fortunes for a penny. Yes, Mr. Harding, she wrote. I would not say so if I was not positive. He will be back. Harding read the paper, then tore it up and threw the pieces at her. She flinched and raised her hand to protect the bruised side of her face from the paper.
Lady, I think you're full of so much bullshit, Harding told her.
She stared at him, and her hand wavered over the pad a second, but then she turned and walked into the nurse's station, sticking the pad and pencil back down in the pocket of her uniform.
Hum,
Harding said. Our conversation was a bit spotty, it seemed. But then, when you are told that you are full of bullshit, what kind of written comeback can you make? She tried to get her ward back into shape, but it was difficult with McMurphy's presence still tromping up and down the halls and laughing out loud in the meetings and singing in the latrines. She couldn't rule with her old power anymore, not by writing things on pieces of paper. She was losing her patience, one after the other. After Harding signed out and was picked up by his wife, and George transferred to a different ward, just three of us were left out of the group that had been on the fishing crew, myself and Martini and Scanlon. I didn't want to leave just yet, because she seemed to be too sure. She seemed to be waiting for one more round, and I wanted to be there in case it came off. And one morning, after McMurphy'd been gone 3 weeks, she made her last play. The ward door opened, and the black boys wheeled in this gurney with a chart at the bottom that said in heavy black letters, McMurphy, Randall, P. Post-operative. And below this was written in ink, lobotomy. They pushed it into the day room and left it standing against the wall, along next to the vegetables. We stood at the foot of the gurney, reading the chart, then looked up to the other end, at the head dented into the pillow. A swirl of red hair over a face milk white except for the heavy purple bruises around the eyes. After a minute of silence, Scanlon turned and spat on the floor.
Ah, what's the old bitch trying to put over on us anyhow, for crap's sakes? That ain't him.
Nothing like him, Martini said.
How stupid she think we are.
Oh, they done a pretty fair job, though,
Martini said, moving up alongside the head and pointing as he talked.
See? They got the broken nose and that crazy scar. Even the sideburns.
Sure,
Scanlon growled.
But hell.
I pushed past the other patients to stand beside Martini.
Sure. They can do things like scars and broken noses, I said. But they can't do that look. There's nothing in the face. Just like one of those store dummies. Ain't that right, Scanlon?
Scanlon spat again.
Damn right. Whole thing's, you know, too blank. Anybody can see that.
Look here, one of the patients said, peeling back the sheet. Tattoos.
Sure, I said. They can do tattoos. But the arms, huh? The arms. They couldn't do those. His arms were big. For the rest of the afternoon, Scanlon and Martini and I ridiculed what Scanlon called that crummy sideshow fake lying there on the gurney. But as the hours passed and the swelling began subsiding around the eyes, I saw more and more guys strolling over to look at the figure. I watched them walk by acting like they were going to the magazine rack or the drinking fountain so they could sneak another look at the face. I watched and tried to figure out what he would have done. I was only sure of one thing. He wouldn't have left something like that sit there in the day room with his name tacked on it for 20 or 30 years, so the big nurse could use it as an example of what can happen if you buck the system. I was sure of that. I waited that night until the sounds in the dorm told me everybody was asleep, and until the black boys had stopped making their rounds. Then I turned my head on the pillow so I could see the bed next to mine. I'd been listening to the breathing for hours, since they had wheeled the gurney in and lifted the stretcher onto the bed, listening to the lungs stumbling and stopping, then starting again, hoping as I listened they would stop for good. But I hadn't turned to look yet. There was a cold moon at the window, pouring light into the dorm like skim milk. I sat up in bed, and my shadow fell across the body, seeming to cleave it in half between the hips and shoulders, leaving only a black space. The swelling had gone down enough in the eyes that they were open. They stared into the full light of the moon, open and undreaming, glazed from being open so long without blinking, until they were like smudged fuses in a fuse box. I moved to pick up the pillow, and the eyes fastened on the movement and followed me as I stood up and crossed the few feet between the beds. The big, hard body had a tough grip on life. It fought a long time against having it taken away. Flailing and thrashing around so much, I finally had to lie full length on top of it and scissor the kicking legs with mine while I mashed the pillow into the face. I lay there on top of the body for what seemed days, until the thrashing stopped, until it was still a while, and had shuddered once, and was still again. Then I rolled off. I lifted the pillow, and in the moonlight, I saw the expression hadn't changed from the blank, dead-end look the least bit, even under suffocation. I took my thumbs and pushed the lids down, and held them till they stayed. Then I lay back on my bed. I lay for a while, holding the covers over my face, and thought I was being pretty quiet. But Scanlan's voice, hissing from his bed, let me know I wasn't.
"Take it easy, Chief,"
he said.
"Take it easy. It's okay. Shut up,"
I whispered.
"Go back to sleep."
It was quiet a while. Then I heard him hiss again and ask,
"Is it finished?"
I told him, "Yeah."
"Christ,"
he said then.
"She'll know. You realize that, don't you? Sure, nobody will be able to prove anything. Anybody could have kicked off in post-operative like he was. Happens all the time. But her, she'll know."
I didn't say anything.
"Was I you, Chief, I'd breeze my tail out of here. Yes, sir. I'll tell you what. You leave out of here, and I'll say I saw him up and moving around after you left, and cover you that way. That's the best idea, don't you think?"
"Oh, yeah. Just like that. Just ask him to unlock the door and let me out."
"No. He showed you how one time, if you think back. That very first week. You remember?"
I didn't answer him, and he didn't say anything else, and it was quiet in the dorm again. I lay there a few minutes longer, and then got up and started putting on my clothes. When I finished dressing, I reached into McMurphy's nightstand and got his cap and tried it on. It was too small, and I was suddenly ashamed of trying to wear it. I dropped it on Scanlan's bed as I walked out of the dorm. He said,
"Take it easy, buddy,"
as I walked out. The moon straining through the screen of the tub room windows showed the hunched, heavy shape of the control panel, glinted off the chrome fixtures and glass gauges, so cold I could almost hear the click of it striking. I took a deep breath and bent over and took the levers. I heaved my legs under me and felt the grind of weight at my feet. I heaved again and heard the wires and connections tearing out of the floor. I lurched it up to my knees and was able to get an arm around it and my other hand under it. The chrome was cold against my neck and the side of my head. I put my back toward the screen, then spun and let the momentum carry the panel through the screen and window with a ripping crash. The glass splashed out in the moon like a bright cold water baptizing the sleeping earth. Panting, I thought for a second about going back and getting Scanlan and some of the others. But then I heard the running squeak of the black boy's shoes in the hall, and I put my hand on the sill and vaulted after the panel into the moonlight. I ran across the grounds in the direction I remembered seeing the dog go, toward the highway. I remember I was taking huge strides as I ran, seeming to step and float a long ways before my next foot struck the earth. I felt like I was flying, free. Nobody bothers coming after an AWOL, I knew, and Scanlan could handle any questions about the dead man. No need to be running like this. But I didn't stop. I ran for miles before I stopped and walked up the embankment onto the highway. I caught a ride with a guy, a Mexican guy, going north in a truck full of sheep, and gave him such a good story about me being a professional Indian wrestler the syndicate had tried to lock up in a nut house that he stopped real quick and gave me a leather jacket to cover my greens and loaned me $10 to eat on while I hitchhiked to Canada. I had him write his address down before he drove off, and I told him I'd send him the money as soon as I got a little ahead. I might go to Canada eventually, but I think I'll stop along the Columbia on the way. I'd like to check around Portland and Hood River and the Dalles to see if there's any of the guys I used to know back in the village who haven't drunk themselves goofy. I'd like to see what they've been doing since the government tried to buy their right to be Indians. I've even heard that some of the tribe have took to building their old ramshackle wood scaffolding all over that big million-dollar hydroelectric dam and are spearing salmon in the spillway. I'd give something to see that. Mostly, I'd just like to look over the country around the gorge again, just to bring some of it clear in my mind again. I've been away a long time. This is John C. Reilly. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc.
The book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is available wherever Viking books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.